Today is Wednesday, July 12th, 2006. I am Sandy Fahler, an interviewer with the University of Wisconsin-Madison Oral History Project. Today I am interviewing Joy Zedler, Professor of Botany and Aldo Leopold Chair in Restoration Ecology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Hello.
Hi.
We're going to start by asking you to talk about your early life, where and when you were born. If you talk about your childhood, your early schooling, did you have any brothers and sisters, what your parents did, talk about any family members or other people that might have influenced you on your future career path.
Sure. I was born in South Dakota, and it was in the 40s. I grew up on a farm. My parents did not go to college. I had a brother who was 2 years older. And I would say that there wasn't any encouragement to go on to school. And in fact, there was discouragement, and which may indeed be the reason that I ultimately did go on to college.
Your parents were not supportive.
Oh, no. No, it was considered in my day, in that part of the world, to be a waste of effort, a waste of money, because women just got married and had kids.
What, were you near any big town, any big city?
We were south of Sioux Falls, South Dakota, about 15 miles.
What was the public school system like there?
Well, I went to a one-room school, York District 21. And I had one classmate. There were 8 grades. I think there were 17 in the school when I started in first grade. There was no kindergarten. And I think there were 12 when I finished. And I was the valedictorian of my class of 2.
So well, was, how did you escape?
Actually I went to a very small high school as well. It was a school of about 100 students in 4 grades. And I had a marvelous English teacher. She was fresh out of Augustana College. And she was fabulous. She taught me typing and bookkeeping and English and journalism. And she herself had come from a very small town and had similar experience and was encouraged by one of her teachers to go on to college. So she had decided I was going to go to Augustana College, and she took me up to the campus and introduced me around, and got me to apply for scholarship help, and introduced me to the admissions people, and I of course was fixated on the idea because I wasn't supposed to do that. And ultimately I did go there. And
now where
got
is
my
that?
Degree. That's in Sioux Falls.
That's in Sioux Falls. Is that a Lutheran school?
It is. I was not Lutheran. But it it was having been encouraged by a person who meant a lot to me, so.
And at that point, your parents stepped back and?
Well, I went, they moved to Rapid City when I was a senior. I stayed with my aunt and uncle, who were very encouraging. And I spent summers working and saving money, so I could pretty much fund myself. Even though it was a private school, it wasn't as expensive as they are today.
Mm-hmm.
But I worked summers. I had 2 jobs my senior summer year.
What job?
I worked as a short-term secretary for a deputy state's attorney, and then at night I was a waitress. And that got me enough money for tuition for the first year. So then I worked during college as a typist. And ultimately became the secretary of the botany or the biology department because at 65 cents an hour. So they didn't have an actual formal secretary. So I typed my way through school.
It sounds like it was an enjoyable experience, though, the whole.
I enjoyed Augustana.
Uh-huh.
As a senior, I got to live with 11 other women, one of whom is still my best friend here on campus because we both ended up in graduate school together and on the faculty together. And another who lives in Southern California who still we visit with every year. And So it was a very special group. Mm-hmm. And about 2 years ago, the college gave me a Career Achievement Award. And I was able to tell this story of how I had been encouraged by my high school English teacher. And it was just a fabulous experience, because when I finished, she came up to me. She was actually there. And had heard this tribute to her. I never imagined that she would be there, because she lives in Idaho and it was in South Dakota. So very special.
I'll say.
Situation.
And what did you major in?
In college?
Yeah.
I started in the 2-year secretarial program, which was what my parents were allowing me to do. Mm-hmm. And then as a junior, I switched to biology with the encouragement of my other really important mentor, who was Sven Froiland, who is the biology department chair. Mm-hmm. And he had really inspired me as a teacher. So he's the one who talked me into going on in graduate school. And then I had another teacher who had come from the University of Wisconsin, mm-hmm. who taught me ecology. And he thought it would be a really good idea if I went to UW-Madison. I had these ideas about being a marine biologist at the University of, or at Oregon State, and it was just serendipity that I had an offer for a teaching assistantship here at Madison before I had an offer from Oregon State, and I had to say yes to the University of Wisconsin before I got an offer from Oregon. So I thought, well, that's okay. I can go to Madison, that'll be okay. And
so you came
great accident that was, I guess. So I came here and came with my friend Bonnie, because she was in sociology, and she had a car, so we could get here. And
That worked out well.
That worked out well, yeah. So. We roomed together for the first year, and then I met my current husband, Paul Zedler, mm-hmm. and we got married after a year. And
was he a graduate student,
mm-hmm.
too?
Yep, we were office mates, so it was destiny, I guess. Mm-hmm. And he was the arboretum botanist for his salary, or his, we call it project assistantship now, I think. And so after living in an apartment for a year, we actually got to live in the arboretum of the university's arboretum. There was a little trailer house there. And so for 2 years while I was finishing up and he was finishing up, we were the caretakers of the arboretum. And here, you know, here's another thing that came full circle. You know, now we have office space in the very spot where that trailer sat and where we lived for 2 years. So coming back here as a faculty member was a big treat.
Talk about your experience in graduate school. Mm-hmm. Did you have professors that you particularly enjoyed that helped you find your path through that process?
You know, I think it was more a case of having peers who were helpful. There were two professors in botany at the time, Grant Cottom and Ori Laux. Ori Laux was my advisor, and he was new on the faculty and struggling with the whole publish or perish arena. And Grant Cottom was, we got along wonderfully, but he was of this same mindset that you're wasting your time on women. They never finish, they just have babies. And so again, I was, I'll dare you to, you know, sort of like dare you to finish, and so I was dared to finish.
Were there other women in the program with you?
Yes, there were. But I think the people who inspired me a lot were, my husband. He was helpful in field work and helped a lot just with discussion of the science. And Glenn Goff was an older student. I remember him particularly. He was a giant of a person with a booming voice and just brilliant, and always kept me on my toes. And frankly, I don't remember all that much about the social situation. There was no social situation in those days. I think we just worked all the time. That's what I remember,
yeah.
Is working day and night. And it doesn't happen these days, you know. Students have lives, but somehow we didn't.
How long did it take you to get your PhD?
I finished in 4 years, so I was in a hurry all my life, and I don't know why. One of my big regrets is that I didn't take more courses. And I had a lot of remedial things to make up, which was kind of a waste of graduate school. I had to take calculus, I had to take organic chemistry, and this was all as a result of having been a secretarial student for 2 years and not really preparing myself for graduate school. Mm-hmm. So I did everything wrong, except coming back here.
Well, then, you're saying coming back here. So where did you go after you received your PhD?
My husband had a one-year postdoc at the University of Missouri. And after that, he got a position at San Diego State University.
At which one?
San Diego State University. And it was a one-year sabbatical replacement. And we said, that won't be so bad. It's only for a year. And 29 years later, we were still there. We had our children there, and both eventually got tenured positions and moved our way up to professor level, and I think had quite a successful, both of us had successful careers there. So we both developed research, followed a lot of research opportunities, developed research programs, produced a lot of graduate students. I had over 36 students finish. I felt restless after a while. After our kids went on to school and graduate school, it seemed like we had sort of accomplished what we could at a state university. And I don't know if you know, there is a two-tier system in California, and we had a doctoral program, but not a lot of students wanted to come to doctoral programs because they had to spend part of their time at San Diego State and then a year at the sponsoring university, which was UC Riverside initially and later UC Davis. But I did have 3 students finish in that program at the doctoral level, but most of my students were masters. And we didn't have things like soils department and a landscape architecture department and a limnology center and hydrologists and all of the support system that's really essential for wetland science and restoration ecology. So being able to come here and experience this wealth of faculty has it's been like Christmas.
I have to back you up a little bit. Do you remember, you said you both got tenured positions. Mm-hmm. Do you remember that? Do you remember getting your tenure?
Oh, yes.
Talk about that a little bit.
That nightmare, yes.
Oh,
I still have a file somewhere called Dirty Deeds.
Was it difficult getting the job in the first place?
Yes, it was. For 3 years I taught part-time on a semester-to-semester basis. I mean, that was the routine for women at that time. My husband was offered a tenure-track position after 1 year, and I was actually teaching part-time at that time, but it was fine with me because that's what I had expected. I had really no plan. So when it came time to apply, well, to think about more permanent positions, I had given up. I thought, let's have a family. And so I was pregnant when the opportunity came to apply for a tenure track position. And then when I actually was up for tenure, they didn't have maternity leave at the time. And so I had taken off one semester. That broke my record of teaching full time. And so the time before I had the kids did not count towards tenure, and I was supposed to have either be a special case where I was supposed to be superwoman in order to have been, or maybe superman in order to have been tenured and promoted. They said I didn't meet that requirement, so I either had to appeal it or wait a year. And I appealed it, and I won the appeal. But by then, it was already a whole year later, and it was they just pushed the paper through as a regular promotion. So it was the most awful year, I think, of my life, because it was this appeal process. I mean, not only the scrutiny itself, but the appeal process and the meetings and the paperwork I had to develop to make my case. And then in the end, it didn't matter anyway. The reason to get tenured at that university was in order to be promoted, which is what I really wanted. And having won the tenure case, I still would have had to go through the promotional review. And so I just forget it. Take what I couldn't do another year of all of those meetings and memos, so I gave up. And didn't make any difference, except my income, of course, never caught up. And but I had two wonderful girls as a result.
Well, when did you come back to Madison?
1998, in January.
In January.
Mm-hmm.
And why?
As I said, I was getting a little restless at San Diego State, having felt that I had accomplished what I could accomplish there. Mm-hmm. And I saw the job announcement for the Leopold Chair, and I thought, well, if there's ever a position that would attract me back to the Midwest, this would be it. And previously, in developing that position, the Botany Department had held a seminar series in which they invited restoration ecologists from around the country to come and talk about their research and to address the question of where is this field going, so that they would be able to develop this position a little better. And apparently, according to some insiders, I was the only one who actually addressed the question of where the field is going, and so that apparently impressed some people at the time. And then my husband and I applied to this position either as competitors or as potentially sharing the position, because we both thought we could fill the bill, both having come from here and both knowing some of the Wisconsin ecology and both wanting a job here. So as it turned out, I think it was a highly controversial hiring. Because I was a female, in part, and I think that had both pros and cons. I think in the con category, there were people who didn't want a woman, and on the pro side, the same thing. There was beginning to be recognition that there was a shortfall of women, especially senior women, in science. And so whether that carried the day or not, I don't know. I know that my academic record is stronger in restoration ecology than my husband's, who is much more of a pure theorist. And I've been told it was stronger than the other candidates, but the other candidates were men. Mm. So there was apparently a lot of kerfuffle there that I didn't know about till I still learn about it, in fact, 8.5 years later. I still learn about what went on during that Zedler hiring. And then the university came up with a parallel position for Paul, and that clinched the deal. Mm-hmm. So he's in the Institute for Environmental Studies half-time, and half-time at the Arboretum, and I'm in the Botany Department half-time, and half-time at the Arboretum.
So what was it? It must have been a committee then from various departments that was mm-hmm. the hiring group then, right?
Yes. And included veterinary school. Inge Keith was the woman on the committee, and Tom Gibbons from and Don Waller from this department, and Brent McCown from horticulture. Those are the ones I remember.
Mm-hmm. So you did you have a fairly clear understanding of the department here and the culture here, and you knew some people, or I realize you've been gone for many, many years, but have
years.
You kept up on what was going on
no,
here?
No, I hadn't really. But the person who was chair at the time was a new faculty member when we had left. That was Ray Evert.
Oh.
And so it was really nice to see a familiar face upon interviewing. And I had met Don Waller at a meeting somewhere, and then I had come for that seminar prior to the job interview. so I had some inkling. I had met Evelyn Howell over in landscape architecture, and she had developed the restoration ecology course and had maintained close ties to the Arboretum, so we had a lot in common. Mm-hmm. And I currently volunteer in that course over in landscape architecture. Mm-hmm. And it felt comfortable to have a former college friend here to stay with we're visiting. But the university didn't seem all that familiar, just because, and I remember working in Burge Hall for 4 years and not doing much else.
Well, has this building changed much?
No.
This is a very nice office.
No. Yeah, I remember this was the mycologist's office. But my graduate student office was about 5 doors down the hallway, so I haven't migrated very far. And my student is now there where I used to sit. So.
Well, talk about your responsibilities. Mm-hmm. As half-time in the botany department, I'm assuming that you teach and you do research and you publish, and mm-hmm. I want you to talk about that too. But what about the half that's in the Arboretum? Mm-hmm. What is that all about?
The Arboretum had actually raised half of the money for the position using the Leopold name and the concept of restoration ecology. And the concept was developed way back in the 1980s when the Arboretum held a symposium and asked a number of notable ecologists to come and talk about where the Arboretum should head. And a wonderful staff person at the Arboretum was William R. Jordan III, whose idea that symposium was. And I think it was his idea to have a Leopold chair. This panel of experts decided to recommend that there be a professorship like this. And the whole idea was to develop a research program at the Arboretum that would take advantage of the Arboretum's plant restorations and other facilities and build that into legacy for the Arboretum. So the whole idea was to develop research and produce graduate students, and that's what I did, or have done, and still am doing.
So talk about your research.
Sure. I work in wetlands, and those are always controversial because there is some protection of wetlands under the Clean Water Act, and the Supreme Court just had a very important decision about which wetlands are protected and which ones aren't, and they have decided that the lower courts should figure that out, and so we're going to have a whole lot of litigation in the next few years. And so my research has always been a bit applied. It's been about what wetlands are like and what happens when you damage them and try to replace them and restore them. That's where the restoration part comes in. In California, I worked on coastal wetlands or salt marshes and places where there were endangered birds and some endangered plants, and where we tried to understand what the impacts of increasing development are and then how to mitigate those impacts by replanting, reintroducing, modifying the habitat, correcting the mistakes that have been made. And so all of that translates very directly to the Arboretum, where we have many of the same kinds of problems with habitat loss and habitat modification and declining native species. But here, in addition, we have major invasive plants that have been brought to Wisconsin and that have expanded very rapidly and displaced a lot of the native plants. So what we're trying to do at the Arboretum is understand how those invasions occur, to try to correct the problems that facilitate invasion, and then figure out what to put back if we can actually control those invaders, and how to restore the native wetlands. And most of my work has focused on wetlands at the Arboretum as well.
And what would you consider your most significant contribution?
To science.
To science, to, mm-hmm. to restoration.
Mm-hmm. It has been to bring science into restoration. And there's a lot of what I'd call seat-of-the-pants work that's been done. Because it's fairly easy for an engineer to say, well, you've got too much stormwater here, divert it over here and build this structure, and walk away from the project, assuming that's all you have to do. If you do the hard biological work, you figure out pretty fast that just leaving it alone doesn't allow it, or just correcting those physical factors doesn't allow the vegetation to come back, and if the vegetation doesn't come back in the same vigorous way that it used to, it won't support the birds. And for many years we worked with our highway department trying to create habitat for endangered birds, and demonstrated that the site was never going to provide habitat for those endangered birds because the substrate itself was wrong. It was dredge spoil, sandy stuff that wouldn't hold nitrogen and plants wouldn't grow. So it's a series of dozens of papers on salt marsh restoration that showed you just have to be very careful and science-based. And I started recommending that the science, or the restoration work and the science, go hand in hand in what I call adaptive restoration, where you set out to do the restoration as experiments that test different approaches, and then as you're restoring, you're also learning the best way to restore. And I got started on that in Southern California and carried that concept to the Arboretum. And we started with Lower Green Prairie, and then more recently Curtis Prairie, and this summer Gardner Marsh, and those are three of our principal wetland areas. And each one of them has different challenges and requires different experimental approaches. But that's what I'm promoting now, is this concept of adaptive restoration, to learn while we restore and make it science-based rather than hit and miss. Mm-hmm. So.
What was your impression of the condition of the wetlands in the Arboretum when you came?
Shock. Yes, and also amazement for the state as a whole. There hasn't been all that much research on wetlands. John Curtis was the principal ecologist here in the botany department before I came here. He died in, I think it was 59, or somewhat shortly after that. And he wasn't particularly a wetland scientist himself, and there weren't a lot of people who followed in his footsteps. So I was amazed at the status of the science as well as the condition of the Arboretum wetlands. The Arboretum has been surrounded by urban area, and with urbanization you get more runoff than naturally, because it comes off the roofs, the sidewalks, the streets. And so we get more water coming into the Arboretum than was ever intended, quote unquote. Along with it comes more nutrients, along with that comes more sediment as people are developing and the erosion's occurring. And as a result, we end up, and it all flows into the wetland, which is the lowest part of the landscape. I call it the landscape sink. And as a result, creates the perfect conditions for invasive plants. The ones that are real opportunistic and love all of that water and nutrients and sediments. And so there's not an easy fix, because we're not going to un-urbanize Madison, right? So it requires, you know, slightly different science, trying to figure out if you can create novel communities of plants that are able to resist these invaders, and how do you establish them, and what attributes will foster the native plant diversity. We just published a really neat paper with a master student, Michelle Peach, in which we show that one key plant in the sedge meadow is Carex stricta, the tussock sedge, and it builds these tussocks that can support up to 20 other species. And so now we need to figure out, how do you jumpstart that process and get that plant to do that more rapidly. And we use a mesocosm facility that I created at the Arboretum, big cattle tanks that are about a meter square in area, and we're varying water levels to see if we can coax the plant to build taller tussocks, and ultimately then we can try to introduce more species. And the key to restoring biodiversity may well be these plants that some people like to call ecosystem engineers. They're plants that modify their habitat. And they're the engineers. The civil engineers don't even know about them. And I think the answer lies, many times, lies in the biology, working in concert with the engineering of the landscape. So we have a nice relationship now with the engineers who are working on trying to reduce the stormwater problems, and the biologists who are trying to restore the habitat. And I felt really good this past spring because we're having some stormwater planning done, thanks to the university.
How is your research funded?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's part of the job, is to raise funding, and I try to serve a lot of different users of knowledge. The National Science Foundation funds mainly the pure science side, and they've been very generous with funding for my salt marsh work in California, which is still continuing and has a nice complementary approach, because it's all about this topographic heterogeneity as well as what I'm doing in the Arboretum. But the people who will actually apply the work tend to be, for example, the Environmental Protection Agency. We've had three projects with them that have involved wetland invasions and wetland restoration. The DNR has been helpful in getting us to funding through one of the EPA wetlands programs here in the region, and that funds some of the invader control research. We have money from the Wisconsin Sea Grant, and that's mostly about coastal wetlands along the Great Lakes, along Lake Michigan. And that's relevant to the Arboretum because it's about the invasion of cattails and the loss of sedge meadows, and we have cattails invading all over the Arboretum. So we're able to do some of the experimental work in the mesocosm facility at the Arboretum. Anybody who will advertise a source of funding, the Corps of Engineers, they regulate wetlands and have some of their own wetland restoration activities, so they've funded some of our work.
Is there a collaboration done with other departments on campus mm-hmm. in this work?
Yes, depending on the source. One of the EPA projects was in their Water and Watersheds program, and that was joint with many different partners. Ken Potter in civil and environmental engineering, Dick Lathrop, who's actually part with the Limnology Center and DNR, Jim LeGros, who's in urban and regional planning, Gene Barr, who's in geology. that was a fun project. Mm-hmm. I've been working to collaborate with Cindy Stiles in the Soils Department on some of our adaptive restoration in Curtis Prairie. It just kind of depends on the question and the project. Right now, I'm one of about 20 collaborators on a new IGRT project, which is NSF's Integrated Graduate Research Education and Training Program. And that project involves biodiversity and the livelihoods and governance in China, in Northwest Yunnan province. And the 20 other, or the 19 other faculty are all over campus. And I'll have my first student entering that program this fall, and she will actually do her work on wetlands in China. I have a former doctoral student who's now a professor at Michoacan in southern Mexico. And he's just hosted one of my master's students who's going to do a parallel experiment in Gardner Marsh and in some spring-fed wetlands in Morelia in Michoacan. So that's a nice international collaboration. Again, whatever My research has a theme, but exactly what I do usually depends on where the money can come from and what questions are hot and will be fundable. And then that suggests who to collaborate with. And so I've got many collaborators for which the projects never got funded. But they've been all over campus.
Is it harder to get money today than it was when you first?
It's a lot harder in Wisconsin than it was in California. And it's a good reason. The reason is we don't have as much development or as much demand for mitigation work here. It was easier to get funding in California because it's so threatened by everything.
Would you talk about your teaching responsibilities?
Mm-hmm. Sure. This is an unusual position because it's half-time, mm-hmm. and so it requires teaching one course a semester and then participating in a seminar. So for the one course, I developed a course called Adaptive Restoration, and it's a lab course in which we work with real clients, and they have to allow us to design restoration work as an experiment in this adaptive approach, and then we divide up into teams to serve each of the clients, sometimes as many as three different clients, sometimes just one. And last year we, for example, worked with the Arboretum and Gardner Marsh trying to develop the experimental approach to restoring areas invaded by cattails. But the year before we had three clients, and that was involving the Environmental Defense Project, which was to restore Hetch Hetchy Reservoir in Northern California. Mm-hmm. And that was interesting because we ended up with a teleconference on the work the students developed. And that was a great experience for them because it's someday that reservoir will get restored, and their phased adaptive approach will be the approach that Environmental Defense takes. Mm-hmm. But it might be a few years before that happens. It's rather political at the moment. So it's a course that provides practical experience as well as scientific background, and then some hands-on field work, and then resulting in an implementable plan.
So that's graduate level?
Undergrads can join too. Mm-hmm. Seniors usually are. Mm-hmm. I think I had a sophomore once.
You enjoy teaching?
Mm-hmm, I do. I really like working with graduate students on their thesis projects. That's really my favorite thing. At San Diego State, I had lots of students, and I picked really good ones. But here, graduate students have such a marvelous community of peers to work with, plus all of the departments that they could ever want to go to for expertise. And fabulous faculty to have on their committees. I learn as much as the students do, I think, when they're doing their research. And I love to see them grow up and become professionals and fledge.
And it sounds like there have been some that have really gone out and are doing some very significant things.
That's right. I don't know if I've counted them. Let's see. But I've had maybe five or six PhD students since I've been here finish up, and maybe about eight master's students. So about two a year finish.
Mm-hmm. Would you talk about, now you've been here since 1998, but mm-hmm. I would guess, coming in as a full professor, have you still been involved in committee work and governance work and mm-hmm. Are there administrative responsibilities that you deal with? And would you talk about that?
Yes, my position was set up so that I would not be on botany committees, although I have volunteered for a search committee, and I volunteered to edit the alumni newsletter for the department. So much of the administrative work has been through the Arboretum or through university-level committees. I was on the graduate research committee for biology for 3 years.
Now, what does that committee do?
Gives out money from the graduate school.
Oh,
and
okay.
requires a lot of evaluation of proposals and interviews of faculty. And it introduced me to the competitiveness of this university. It also reviews all of the named professors' applications, and I didn't enjoy that. I don't like being that judgmental of people. And again, the competitiveness amongst people on the committee and different departments and schools on campus wasn't that much fun. Mm-hmm. But I learned how the system works. And I served on mentoring committees for a number of people. I think I'm popular because I'm female. And
now, what does a mentor do in that mm-hmm. situation?
Okay.
For new
faculty who come and are trying to get tenure. I think it's a wonderful system. I wish I'd had a mentoring committee. But usually it's very formally developed and meets once a year, at least, with the prospective associate professor or promotee. And we go over the materials that they're preparing for the divisional review committee, the departmental and divisional review committees, and try to help them make the best case for their work and make sure their teaching is evaluated in person so we can write letters and have documentation of they're doing a good job. Coaching and trying to point out before somebody else does which gaps need to be filled and how to get promoted. So that's quite rewarding because I think everybody who comes here with a high aspirations, and you know, we don't get losers. They're winners if they get hired. And then to just help them win the next level of evaluation is quite rewarding.
So can you be a mentor to someone from any department
mm-hmm.
on campus?
And I'm a mentor for a bioengineering young woman, the only woman in her department. And she just had a baby, and I feel like I'm a grandma. I'm a mentor for a soils professor, again a woman. I'm a mentor for an entomologist who's a man. I'm a mentor for an assistant professor in my department who's a woman. So those four committees.
And how do they find you? How do they?
I have no idea.
Really? I mean, are you on a list or?
Oh, how do they locate me?
Yeah.
I thought you meant in this British sense of how good am I?
No, but I mean.
Okay. How do they locate me? Okay. I don't know for sure. In the case of the entomologist, he had worked in salt marshes and he knew I was here on the faculty and would understand his postdoctoral salt marsh work.
But how do they know that you're willing to be a mentor?
Oh, they ask. That's all.
I see.
Yeah.
Okay.
So they kind of have a responsibility of lining up a committee along with somebody in their department mm-hmm. who says yes, that person would be suitable or not.
Mm-hmm.
So we get graded, I guess.
I see.
I think, you know, my guess is that because I'm a woman, if a woman comes into a department where there are no women, they're going to try to find some women on campus. Mm-hmm. And because there is a paucity of senior women, you're not going to be a mentor if you're an assistant professor,
sure.
right? So I think that's why I'm popular,
yeah.
because I'm rare. I really don't know how big the pool is on campus, but I know it's not huge.
Well, that actually leads into the next question very well. Would you talk about the climate for women here? How does it help or hinder the participation and advancement of women?
Yeah, I'm going to speak generally because
we
I do
talk
want
about
you
it at how it was in San Diego,
yeah,
or
yeah,
in comparison. Or
but because this will be made available to people, I'm not going to tell all.
No, that's fine.
I was quite shocked when I returned to Wisconsin after being in California. The culture in California is far more supportive and promotive of women, and there were more women in the field and in my department there. And I was oblivious to discrimination. I had been able to do what I wanted to do, and I kind of rose to the top of the my peers and had never experienced anything that I would call discrimination. And when I came back here, I was I could feel the difference. I have a a sociologist friend who says, you know, when something happens and you can't explain it any other way, it's probably discrimination. And I know that the hiring was controversial, and I know that being a woman played some role in it. And that was quite perceptible. It wasn't outright or direct. It was indirect. And there have been some heroes on this campus who are correcting those problems. And I think it's no secret that Wisconsin had a problem. After all, we got a Women in Science and Engineering Leadership Institute funded by NSF to the tune of $10 million to correct problems that were known on this campus. And they involved women that I've since met and have found to be fabulous. And what could it be other than discrimination? My sociologist friend had done a survey of salaries of women versus men at this university and shown disparities at every level. Our own chancellor was filmed by the Women in Science and Engineering Leadership Institute saying, and I quote, "At every level, in every field, women outperform men. So why do they advance so slowly?" Unquote. So it's not just my perception, but it has been an issue. Now, the Women's Leadership Institute, I think, has done a terrific job. And
what are some of the things that they've done?
Molly Carnes and Joe Handelsman get a lot of credit, if not all the credit. One of the things they did very early on was to interview senior women in science and engineering to find out what the situation was, and then to encourage, I would say mentor, and I think they are the ones who developed this program of life cycle awards. If you're having a baby or if you have parental care issues or other crises in your life, then you can apply and get support and your tenure can be delayed. Those are things that have been important. They have, I think, just worked with departmental chairs to understand discrimination, and I have no idea what all they've done, but they have made a difference. And I know that they've worked with our current dean, Dean Cadwallader, and were actually a part of the hiring process for that deanship. And we're looking out for women being hired in letters and science.
Is there
in graduate school?
Are there opportunities for formal or informal interaction with other women in other departments on campus? Networking.
I think they also fostered that, and there is a group that I don't interact with much called Women in Science, and I'm not that much of a joiner, so I found that I am absolutely overwhelmed with what I have to do, and so I haven't joined in, but those opportunities are there. Mm-hmm. And informally, I do interact with a number of women, but, you know, it's a 24-hour day job, so I kind of go home and collapse.
Now, do you belong to professional organizations, and can you talk about that?
I belong to a lot of scientific societies and attend one or two conferences per year, and they often have activities for minorities of many sorts, not just women. But I'm sure there are women's networks. I've never taken advantage of them.
Do you find that the professional associations and organizations you belong to, have those been important to your career?
Yes, I think a mistake I made was not focusing on a single one and spreading myself a bit thin. As a salt marsh ecologist, I was active in the Estuarine Research Federation and was at one point the vice president of that organization and a program chair for a national conference. And I probably would have continued to do more, but then I moved to Wisconsin, and we don't have estuaries here. So that's probably now my second most important, or third most important organization. The Ecological Society is the biggest one. It's about 8,000 members, and I was an officer there as well, and have a marvelous network of people. They publish a lot of journals, and I've been on editorial boards of many journals. And I do think that's important to do those things. The Society for Wetland Scientists is a little smaller, and I've never really served that organization other than as an occasional reviewer of papers. So I would advise younger faculty to specialize in one or two organizations. I probably belonged to half a dozen, and I would, you know, if the meeting is nearby, I'd go to the Society for Ecological Restoration, or if it was this wetlands people, then I might go to that one. Sometimes I just want to go to the place where they're meeting, so I went to Spain a couple summers ago, and that was the ecological restoration meetings. And we've been trying to get some of them to come here in Madison. I'm trying to get the wetland people to come in 2009, and we tried to get the restoration people to come. So my participation has been sporadic, let's put it that way. But the thing I have done the most consistently is serve as a reviewer and assistant editor for several different journals.
Would you talk about your publications? Mm-hmm. Do you enjoy that part of your job? Do you like the writing? And
I do love to write. And I find that even when I finish writing something, I'm just not happy until I start something else. That's what just happened this last week. I spent the entire weekend writing a self-study because we're going to have a review at the Arboretum sometime next fall. And I just had to be writing something. So I said, okay, I'll write down what I've done for the last 8.5 years. And how we developed the research program. So I'm ready for your questions. let's see. I've published a lot of stuff, a couple hundred publications. And what I am finding these days is that it's less fun than it used to be.
Because?
It's less fun because of the technology that has made it, quote, easier to revise and review, and when in actuality makes it much more work. Because you can change one more thing, you are asked to change 100 more things, and the reviewers today are trying to rewrite your papers, and it's not just about correcting mistakes and flagging things. It's about rewriting them. And so you go through 20, 30 iterations of a paper, which is not a time saver. And we all, you know, even if we're good writers, we all can write differently. And we are perceived to have to write the way the particular reviewer wants to read it. Mm-hmm. And it's the luck of the draw. The same paper. I've had a really bad experience with a wonderful female doctoral student who just finished up. I don't know. I think we tried 3 journals, same paper. And, you know, you get 3 reviewers, and they each make you revise it to their specifications. Then then they reject it, and you try another journal, and then you've got 3 different people who want you to write to their specifications, and they reject it. And so then, you know, We've been through 3 journals, trying our 4th now, and it's because it's rather cutting-edge stuff that people aren't ready for yet. It will get published, and we just have to keep rewriting it for the one journal that will eventually get the right 3 reviewers. Mm-hmm. So it's and everything has to be submitted electronically now. And that, again, is supposed to be a time saver, but it's only a time saver for the journal publisher. It's not a time saver for the writer, because you have to learn all these different websites, and they're all different. They're all traumatic. I think the next generation that has grown up with talking to a machine is going to have a much easier time, because this is what my daughters tell me, that, you know, but Mom, you learned the old way. I do not like to interact with this machine, other than I like word processing, but having to reject something because what did I do wrong this time to get the password right, and whatever it is, you know? And then, you know, keeping track of 100 different passwords. And so I don't enjoy that anymore. And I don't enjoy the reviewing process all that much anymore.
Do your graduate students come in knowing how to write?
No.
So that's your responsibility?
I do enjoy teaching them to write, though. So a lot of what I do is suggesting how they can improve their writing and thinking, critical thinking skills, and how they can master this publishing game, which is not innate. And I really enjoy seeing their work mature. So usually a doctoral student will do 3 papers, and the first one is just so much work and takes maybe 5 or 6 iterations. And I'm one of those reviewers that I complain about, by the way.
I see.
Right? Because I can see how they can make it better to please me. But I also think I represent their committee in making sure that they will get passed. And every single one of my students has been complimented on how well their theses have been written, and I'm positive that helps them get through the examination process and gives them confidence and eases the strain. So they learn to write. By the 3rd manuscript, it only takes a couple of reviews, and they're done. So they do learn, and it's fun to watch that happen. So, and we get such good students. That's the other thing I like so much about UW-Madison, is that the students are top caliber, and you can pick the cream of the crop. I've had several who have been university fellows. Just this place, and the Arboretum with its legacy of restoration and restoration science is it's an automatic draw for really good students who want to go into this field. So I'm really fortunate. And I know some departments have trouble finding graduate students, but I have maybe 20, 30, 40 who inquire every year, and I can maybe take 2 or 3, or 1.
So this program continues to just get stronger and stronger,
mm-hmm.
than the way it sounds.
It does. Yes. And it's now I'm trying to expand it a little bit because there's a lot of demand for the practice of restoration, and I'd like to develop practica, or practical experience, for people who want to go into the business of restoring ecosystems, and to do that at the Arboretum, where they can experience chainsaws and herbicides and mowing and burning and all of those practical skills, along with the science, where they learn to test things as they go, so that they don't just think they can write a cookbook on how to restore an ecosystem. It's much too complicated for that.
My last question before we leave your life at the university and talk more about your life after work is, if would you talk about any honors and awards that you've received that you're particularly proud of?
Mm. I mentioned earlier that my undergraduate college gave me a Career Achievement Award, and that was really very special because it was a little Lutheran college, and for them to pick a scientist, I think was a pretty big deal. And I really appreciated that, and that opportunity to thank my undergraduate organization. I'm proud to have received an award from the Society for Ecological Restoration. The circular one up there is the Peter Sperry Award from the Society for Ecological Restoration.
It's the what?
The Theodore Sperry Award.
And what is that for?
Well, Ted Sperry, I got this when I was in San Diego, but Ted Sperry was one of the people who restored plants to the prairie of the Arboretum, and the Society of Ecological Restoration kind of arose as a result of activities of Bill Jordan and others here at the Arboretum. So I had that connection before I even came here. It was really fantastic then to come here and be able to give something back to the Arboretum. I was an outstanding educator with the Eastern Research Federation, and the name of William Nearing, who was a very well-known ecologist who actually worked on salt marsh restoration back in Connecticut College, and feel proud about that.
Mm-hmm.
a number of other things that along the way, but those are nice ones. I was quoted in Science last week. That always is a fun thing.
What was that about?
The Supreme Court ruling on wetlands. And we're trying to figure out now how to advise the lower courts and the Corps of Engineers in how to decide which wetlands they should regulate.
Were you hoping that the Supreme Court would rule on this? Or
I was relieved that they didn't simply reduce the regulation of wetlands. I was fearful that that's what would happen. Mm-hmm. And fortunately, they came to a draw with one person saying, send it back to the lower courts. So it was close. We could have lost a lot of wetland protection. We were very, very close. And I would say, along the lines of awards, it's been my pleasure to serve both the Nature Conservancy and the Environmental Defense as a on their national boards. Mm-hmm. And currently, I'm on the state board for Wisconsin Wetlands. Wisconsin chapter of the Nature Conservancy. And that allows me to vote yes when they want to buy up lands and conserve them. And there's just that 60,000 acre forest legacy project that just was finalized by the Nature Conservancy. And in a couple of weeks, I get to go out and see it. So it's really rewarding kind of service. I'm not sure if that's outside of work or the same as work.
Oh, I'd say it was
but
the
it's
same.
It's very, very closely aligned with my research interests. And the work that I do with things like the Supreme Court decisions and advising on wetlands regulation, that's a lot of that's with the Environmental Defense, which mm-hmm. is a strong national environmental organization. International, I should mm-hmm. say.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything else you'd like to add before I ask you some questions about your life after work, about your career here? Or
I didn't mention something that I think is very important to, especially to young women, in that undergraduates are encouraged to do research at this university, which I think is wonderful, through the honors program and the BioCorps. And through many classes, they're encouraged to do special studies work. And so I've had many young men and women. Last year I had a young man in my lab, and he did a senior thesis, and now he's back for a graduate degree. And he's the one who's working in Mexico and in the Arboretum. So I think that undergraduate emphasis on research is very important, and I was surprised to see it at a big university like this. Mm-hmm. And I know that's one of the priorities. I'd also like to say a little something about diversity on campus, not just gender, but it was also a big change coming from Southern California, which is a hot pot, or a melting pot of diversity, to come here. And always looking for opportunities to take on some of our advanced opportunity fellows and to bring more diversity into my lab. I was thrilled to have a couple of students from Mexico and Chinese American, and there just isn't a big enough pool to draw from. But I have a couple of students who have Hispanic heritage, so it'd be nice to have more.
Yeah. Well, you're working on
it. Yeah, right. One at a time.
Yeah. All right, well now, would you talk about your family, how you balance work and family, what you do for fun and relaxation when you're not working, and how do you stay healthy and energetic?
I haven't noticed that I'm healthy.
I think you have to be healthy to balance as many things as you do in your life.
I don't think they're balanced at all.
Okay.
Yeah. I'd have to say I don't balance. That was one of my regrets, I think, that as a mother, I put my career first, and I'm ashamed of that. I love my kids, and I fit them in.
You said you have two daughters?
Yeah, they're twins. I think that was one of the efficiency measures of surviving pre-tenure motherhood.
What are their names, and what are they doing?
Emily and Sarah, and Emily has her PhD, and she's now a floodplain modeler with Santa Clara Water District in the Bay Area of California.
Obviously influenced by her.
She she was influenced by, they both were influenced by a junior high school math teacher who got him interested in math. And then my husband was really good sitting around the dinner table while I was doing dishes. They would do their math homework, and he was really strong in that area. And then they had good teachers, and a couple good teachers in high school.
And was that San Diego Public Schools?
It was. It was a, not only that, it was a city center type school with, they were in the minority as Caucasians. And all of our neighbors sent their kids to the private school up in La Jolla. And I didn't have time for the carpooling. So my poor kids got this marvelous education where they learned to get along with people who spoke many, many different languages. People from over 30 countries in that school. And they were, like I say, they were in the minority. And they have been comfortable with every nationality and culture ever since, I think, as a result of that experience. So coming to Madison, for me, was a bit of a change. I had remembered how white it is here. And I had forgotten that not every university has the rich cultural heritage that San Diego can draw on. At any rate, we're talking about my kids.
Yeah,
so
Sarah,
Sarah is finishing her PhD at Scripps Institution of Oceanography, and her work is on in physical oceanography, and she's doing computer modeling of the effects of hurricanes on ocean mixing. And very esoteric and theoretical stuff. But hurricanes are in the news, and so she might finish up this winter. And let's see, Emily's just gotten engaged, so she's going to figure out how to juggle her career correctly.
So do you get out to California to see them?
I do. Actually, these meetings that I attend for environmental defense once a year are in the Bay Area, and I still attend to some of my research in the San Diego area. They never seem to catch them both on the same trip, but and they come back here to visit. But it's we're on the phone almost, weekly with Emily and almost daily with Sarah, so I do find time for them now. In my guilt-ridden years, and I did most of the you know, after-school pickup. But I always said my kids were raised by committee because we didn't have childcare. There was no formalized childcare, and so I had to find people.
And you didn't have any relatives.
I had no relatives. That's right. And I don't know how they survived. In their kindergarten year, I sent them to two kindergartens because kindergarten was only half a day. So they went to Montessori half a day, and then they went to public school half a day. And they survived.
They not only survived, they're getting their PhD.
Poor kids. I think they were about 3 years old when I finally realized that they did realize I was their mother. They knew I was their mother. And then later, when we could talk about these things as more like in high school, and I would ask them, well, what was it like? And they'd say, well, how do we know? We don't know any other way. So I don't think there's a wrong way, but I think we could have done a lot more with them to make them more socially well-rounded, maybe less of a bookworm. But I like them.
Now, what do you do for fun and relaxation?
Right. My husband, I finally talked my husband into buying some land, and so we live just outside of Madison where we have invasive plants and land to care for.
Where do you live?
It's the West Wabisa area, just north of Oregon.
In the town of Dunn?
In the town of Dunn. Do you really? Marvelous place. It's marvelous. And so in my spare time, I fight development for the town of Dunn. And just published an editorial in the Cap Times on why the wetlands of Oregon, or the West Wabisa area, are so precious, and we shouldn't have that development that's being proposed by the city of, or the town of Fitchburg, and so on, and why we shouldn't have the power line across the Wabisa wetlands. So that's fun. I find that fun. I think it's really a neat community because they have formed this conservation group that fights back and is effective. So I guess I practice what I preach. I like to cook and I like to bake. My husband and I built a wood-fired brick oven a couple years ago, and I bake bread almost every weekend, if not every other. And I'm an adaptive cook, so that's kind of like my science as well. You know, I never really make the same thing twice. Just try always to see what will work.
Uh-huh.
And nothing ever turns out the same either.
And you travel?
I travel mostly for work, not really for pleasure. My husband and I travel a lot, but almost never the same place at the same time.
No.
So I really, really like being at home, appreciating our property. We have a bunch of springs and a creek and restored prairie and woods and big sedge meadow, and it's such a pleasure not to travel. So I enjoy not traveling in my spare time. Most people would say the opposite, but I don't like the airplane travel anymore. So I try to keep it to a minimum, and I try to keep it to one trip a month, and that's hard. I try to encourage everybody to do teleconferences instead of face-to-face.
Mm-hmm. Are your parents still living?
My dad is. My dad is 88.
He's in South Dakota?
Mm-hmm.
And your brother?
He's in the Minneapolis area. He's retired.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've got...
Did he go on to college?
Yep. He got a bachelor's degree. Yeah. And he was an engineer for Honeywell. And he has three kids and grandkids and way ahead of me in the reproductive arena.
Do you have any pets?
No. We have insects. We have mosquitoes. we have little field mice that come in the basement. No, I think that that's a shortcoming of being a professional in academia. And you know, it's interesting, most of my students don't want to be like me, and that's good. They don't want to follow in my footsteps because they don't want to go to a big university academic job. They know that it consumes your life. The most they'll talk about for academia is a small college where they wouldn't have to publish or perish. Roberto, the one in Mexico, is the closest to a replicate. And I do have a San Diego State graduate, Peggy Fong, who is now an associate professor at UCLA. So mm-hmm. she would be following in my footsteps.
Mm-hmm.
And she also has twins. She is far more energetic than I am. And it's just not something that I think students today in biology really want to do. They don't want to give their whole life to their job, and I admire that. And I don't know if I have the personality to have been different or not. I think I'm very goal oriented and a workaholic, so I might have been destined. But
well, as you said, you were told that you couldn't do this.
Yeah, that's probably part of it.
Mm-hmm. So students have more opportunities.
They have more choice, and I don't think that I ever planned my career. It was really more, I call myself a weed sometimes, because you take advantage of opportunities and try to flourish where you can, rather than planning something that you can pace. My daughter, Emily, was offered a faculty position at the University of Illinois, Champaign-Urbana, which is top engineering school in the country. And I admire her for turning it down.
And she did it for some of the same reasons you're...
She did. She did not want to be consumed by her work. She also likes the mountainous area where she is on the bay and the culture of Northern California. And of course, she is a Californian. But primarily, it was just not wanting to be consumed by a career.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually like being consumed by the science and the education, but I wish I could control the pace. That's the problem. And somebody's got to figure that out in the next generation, as to that balance that you referred to. Or maybe some of your other interviewees have figured it out, and I should listen to them.
Well, they're open to the public.
Yeah, they're too late for me.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much
You're
for
welcome.
Doing this. It was very important and very good interview.
So where do you live?